newspress.com.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. And CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. So we're here today with Dr. Richard Applebaum, a professor emeritus at the Department of Global Studies and Sociology at UCSB and a current professor at the Fielding Graduate University. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
So the Department of Global Studies and Sociology, what is the nexus between those two? That was a surprise when I saw that.
Well, I would say one of the principal nexus or nexi is me. So I began my career at UCSB as a sociologist, my PhD from University of Chicago's in sociology. But I became interested in globalization maybe 25, 30 years ago as a result of a trip to Thailand, which was a vacation. But I was just blown away by the dynamism and development. It didn't really correspond to the fantasy that I had. So I came back and joined an academic senate committee, which was charged with internationalizing UCSB. Your listeners may not know this, but UCSB and the master plan for the University of California, developed in 1964, is the international campus. Probably because we're not Berkeley or UCLA, we're sort of in the middle of whatever. So that committee was trying to create a program in international studies. And I said, hold on a sec. The international, which has to do with countries as actors and conflicts between nation states, is being superseded by the global, by these forces that cross borders, currency, money, electronics, religious beliefs, culture. Pretty much everything, the environment. So I pushed for that, and that was not successful initially. But along the way, for a lot of reasons, the university decided to create a program in global and international studies. And just say one more thing about that. The crucial thing in that name, global and international, is the ampersand. Because in my view, anyhow, in the view of that department, the international world of nation states was being challenged by these transnational forces that were eroding away at the power of nations, of countries. So it's like these tectonic plates moving back and forth. So to make a long story short, we created that program. It grew to close to 1,000 majors overnight, immensely popular. I sort of moved my position increasingly into global studies. The fantasy I had all along is create a 2-year semi-professional master's program that would send students abroad for 6 months to work for nonprofits and things like that. And that proved to be elusive until Paul Orfila, the founder of Kinko's, graciously decided to give us a $10 million endowment. Then the university decided this was a great idea. Mm-hmm. So the master's program was created, which I ran and pretty much until my retirement a few years ago. And we've now had well over 100, maybe 150 students by now who have gone through that program, done work overseas, and, you know, come back, and many then go on to work for nonprofits, non-governmental organizations, so on. We also have a PhD program now. So global studies has sort of reached, and I'll just say one more thing about that, which is that we've gone global. We've created a consortium of global study programs around the world, and if any of your listeners are interested in these issues, they should come to UCSB or go to City College, which has a related program. I worked with Peter Haslund there to create a program which would articulate so students could come to UCSB with the pre-major pretty much completed. We send more students to study abroad through the UC Education Abroad program than any other unit in the entire University of California. So, I mean, I obviously have a lot of, I'm biased towards this program because I and two other colleagues, Giles Gunn and Mark Juergensmeyer, created it. But I think it's a great program. It's a great opportunity for students, especially undergraduates.
Is it safe to say that no one in the Trump administration has taken those courses?
I think it's pretty safe to say that. Yeah, I'd have to do a little research on that. I always worry that someone in the Trump administration will infiltrate those courses, but that's another topic we won't go into.
It's interesting because you talk about, you know, the nationalism in a way and then globalization, but there's another way that I think another thing that we need to think about, which is just kind of like if one is macro, then micro, which is sort of the what I think academics call the atomization of societies, where you've got this breakdown even within a country of similar interests and desires, and so you've got this push pull. You've got on the one hand, you know, you've got to deal with the supply chain. You've got to deal with tariffs. On the other hand, you've got to deal with your own people because they seem to be splitting away.
Well, I totally agree with that. Many years ago, when I first started looking into this, I was sort of on the road giving a talk where I said there are four sort of mega trends that are going to shape the world of the future. One was globalization, which I just mentioned, these transnational forces. Another is the environment, the limits to growth and challenges to the environment. The third was what I call the declining nation state, the fact that what we now call countries are recent inventions. We used to live in tribes, and now they've coalesced into 190-odd countries, but those combinations are somewhat arbitrary. And I predicted the result of these three forces, environmental constraints on growth, globalization, the nation states would weaken, borders would become more porous, and the result would be a resurgence in what I call tribalism, which is what you're talking about, which is focusing in on one's own people to the detriment of everyone else, and we are now seeing that. So when we created Global Studies, we thought that the global was everything. But now we see a lot of pushback, and we're seeing the rise again of nation-state-based politics, geopolitics, if you will, rivalry with China and all of that.
And the consequences of not understanding this led to the Iraq War. The whole know-nothingism of so many of our political leaders today, where they don't understand history, they don't understand sociology, they don't understand the trends that are taking place. They make decisions based upon a 1939 history of this country is going to move here, this country is going to move here, and so the ignorance is really profound, and it costs not only economic growth, it costs lives.
Well, that's quite frightening. And we see this throughout the world today, throughout Europe, the whole Brexit issue, the rise of right-wing nationalism. I'm tempted to say fascism. It's not that yet. But we see this in Brazil, in the Philippines. India, China have moved towards more authoritarian directions. And again, I think in a way it's predictable because as countries become less effective in delivering the goods, which democracies expect, people will then turn to strong, what they perceive as strong leaders. And I think the prospects are quite frightening, actually.
Well, de Tocqueville said that he said this in 1850 or 1835, whenever he was floating around this country, he said the thing he worries most about the American democracy is a stupid electorate. And, the problem is that democracies have some real problems, and the best solution to dictatorships, on the other hand, depends who's voting.
Right. Well, so, H. L. Mencken famously said, "You'll never go broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people." Now, that's quite insulting, actually. And I think there are people who shouldn't be voting. Well, everyone should be voting. I don't want to back myself into a corner. But I think one problem, which is a topic we may or may not want to get into, is the effort to disenfranchise voters, the whole voter identification business that's going on. Chris Kaulbach, from Kansas and a short-lived effort under the Trump administration to create a commission on electoral reform, or whatever it was called. There's a real effort to keep large numbers of people disenfranchised, and I do think that's a problem. I think that the Democrats have introduced, I think their H.R. 1 or whatever it is, includes a measure for mandatory voting. I can't recall exactly, but it's some way to ramp up voter registration, which generally speaking would favor Democrats because the people who are most disenfranchised, who have the most difficulty voting, are people who typically trend Democrats. Not that I want to make a partisan statement here, but in this environment, I will.
Yeah, and one of the problems is that people who are looking to cut access to voting are, in a way, not only looking at minority groups, they're looking at educated people. I mean, the fact is that, you know, educated people are the bane of the existence of a lot of dictators, because if you're smart and you read and you know about history, you can sort of, you're better prepared to deal with dictatorship.
Right. Well, since we are quoting quotes, there is the philosopher Santayana's famous quote, "Those who don't understand history are condemned to repeat it." And I do think that's true. But China has a lot of highly educated people who seem to be falling in line behind an increasingly authoritarian regime there.
Yeah, well, two reasons probably for that, and you know better than I do. One is that they're used to it, and two is they're scared of it. And those two realities are sort of very, very likely to cause people to fall in line.
Right. I actually think there's a third reason, which is pretty pivotal, which is that a lot of people have been raised out of poverty into middle-class status, and as long as the economy is strong in this country, in any country, people will sort of acquiesce. Many people will acquiesce. In China, of course, if you don't acquiesce, you're in big trouble.
Now, of course, one of the things that has happened in China, which is one of the things I'm sure that you have done a lot of research on, is that they've taken, they basically had an industrial revolution without a revolution, but they've also poisoned the air. And so people have to make that trade-off between the fact that their kids may have all kinds of diseases and the fact that they have a good job.
Right. So China, we can get into this more after the break, but China currently vastly outspends the U.S. on environmental, sustainable environmental practices. Something like half of all the new electric vehicles in the world are made in China. China's electric vehicle requirements have required Ford, General Motors, and other foreign companies that do business in China to comply. So China is well aware of its environmental problems and I think is doing its best. They're spending far more than the U.S. is to try to grapple with these issues.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Richard Applebaum, a professor of emeritus of at UCSB in the departments of Global Studies and Sociology, and currently a professor at Fielding Graduate University. And we were talking just a moment ago before the break about some of the things that are going on in China. And in today's New York Times, there's this article that talks about how in every area of America, for sure, and in most countries, boys begin to not do as well as girls in school, except for Asians. And they're trying to figure out why Asian boys do as well as girls as young children. And they found that it has to do with the image of masculinity in different cultures. And in the Asian, this is what the article said at least, in the Asian communities, it is thought to be cool and good to be smart and to be academic. Whereas in America and other Western countries, males tend to think of it as either effeminate or not important, and so they'll play with their football instead. Is this true?
Is it true?
Yeah, it was in the New York Times today. It must be true, right?
I read it in the New York Times, in the science section, probably.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, first of all, I'm just going to completely equivocate and say, whenever you come with a social theory, truth or falsity is a matter of degree. Things are always more complex. I mean, I've not studied this, but that explanation certainly makes sense. I mean, China has emphasized, especially science and engineering and math, and with a one-child policy, so much pressure is placed on the one child, the son or the daughter, to excel, that it's not surprising that many excel in these areas. Another possible explanation might be that under communism, the rights of women were highly valued. And so, you know, even before China sort of moved on what Deng Xiaoping called the capitalist road, there is an emphasis on women's rights and things like that. And I think I'm sure there's plenty of gender inequality, but in many of the labs and universities I visited over the last decade or so in China, there are many women working in these labs. So I think it's a combination of sort of public policy and cultural pressures also.
What do you think of this narrative that most businessmen and Trump have about China, that China is this evil country that's stealing all our ideas, that is not a fair player and has taken advantage to the extent that it's put so many of our businesses out of business?
Well, that is a question that I have been thinking a lot about lately. So I should mention, I spent probably 11 years in China studying China's transition from basically a low-wage economy producing stuff in factories to an innovative economy. And I can talk a lot about that. The Center for Nanotechnology and Society was 10-year center. I was one of the co-principal investigators. I led a large research team on China. It was a $13 million center. We had a lot of funds. We did surveys, travel, and so on. So it's happening now sort of as reminiscent of other experiences I've had when the drumbeat starts to vilify an enemy. I'm old enough to remember and to have been active when Vietnam and the domino theory and the fact that the world would, terrible things would happen if the communists weren't defeated in Vietnam.
Of course, the irony was that Vietnam hated the Chinese, which shows you we had no insight into what was really going on there.
Right, exactly. So contrary to the domino theory, you know, Vietnam won that war, immediately began trading with the U.S., and went to war with China for a short period also. So as you pointed out earlier, our complete ignorance. And then, of course, well, we've seen other things, the Iraq War. Every time this happens, there's literally a drumbeat that comes from all quarters to kind of get everybody fired up that unless we get on the bandwagon, all hell's going to break loose and we'll be in big trouble. So in 2006, China adopted something called the Medium and Long-Term Plan for Science and Technology Development. It's a 15-year plan. Which called for China to move from imitation to innovation. It was immediately denounced in a report by the American Chamber of Commerce as a web of industrial policies. That was what China talked about was what they called indigenous innovation. They wanted to be able to innovate on their own and not just use foreign technology. And the title of the report was Indigenous Innovation, a web of industrial policies. Just the web of industrial policies has a sinister sound to it. It also said it was a blueprint for technology theft on a degree never before seen. That has now been echoed by numerous publications from the U.S. Trade Representative, Department of Commerce, and so on. The Trump administration is beating this drum hard, and Trump has beat this drum for a long time on this issue. So, it's a long story, which I'll certainly talk about, but I can tell you my conclusion. There are some problems. China has engaged in some outright hacking of, you know, of technological secrets. So has every country and every business. Maybe China's done it worse. I don't know. That's bad. That shouldn't be done. But there are other issues which are much more fundamental and which I think are much more questionable. One is forced technology transfer. If a business wants to do business in China, it does a joint venture with a Chinese company which has access to its intellectual property. This is, for the most part, on a voluntary basis. Businesses do this because the businesses they partner with require it. It's not officially a Chinese government requirement, although it may be a big Chinese government expectation. So that's another issue which we can talk more about. Third one is the trade deficit, which I think is phony. And I'll be glad to explain why that's the case. And I think the biggest issue is what that initial study I mentioned calls industrial policy. Industrial policy is when the government spends money on industries to make them globally competitive. It's been done by every country, including the U.S., but we want China to stop doing that.
Do you think that politicians are purposefully ignorant? That is, they have faith in a theory, and they're not interested in talking to people like you who've been on the ground and have studied the problem? Or do you think it's more cynical than that, is that they're just trying to benefit for their own moneyed interests? But because it's, you know, talking to you, it seems so logical. Why aren't you in Washington right now instead of sitting here talking to me?
I was in Washington once testifying before the U.S. Economic and Security
Commission. They didn't listen to you, though.
On China. And I was making this very case when Senator Sherrod Brown walked in, and I was bumped immediately, and he gave a big pitch on how the Chinese were stealing our jobs. He's a good guy and a working-class guy and a guy I have enormous respect for, a potential presidential candidate for the Democrats. I wanted to say, you know, those days are over. It's robots that are taking your jobs now. Don't be a China basher. Well, I was going to say his presence trumped me. Bad joke. Okay.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
C
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, improving attitude, creating social harmony, bridging the achievement gap for teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Richard Applebaum, a professor at Fielding Graduate University and formerly at the Department of Global Studies and Sociology at UCSB. And it's too bad that the world isn't listening, because we have decided we have the solution to all of the world's problems. And this is an important interview, isn't it?
I hope to be elected Philosopher King.
But, Philosopher King, which is a job that used to be important, didn't it? There were these, you know, they weren't called philosophers then, but, you know, the king
just
did.
Kings.
Yeah, just kings.
Or priests.
So let's get to a little bit of a technical subject, but one that I think could be looked at as emblematic of this whole problem, the supply chain. I mean, right now, the world is not making steel in the steel belt and then shipping it to Detroit and they make a car. Right now, there's cross-border transactions that may take a computer 6 or 7 times between it gets moved back and forth between it gets made. Can you have the fight that some people are trying to have against China and Mexico with the reality of what the supply chain looks like today?
Well, so I'll give you an example with China specifically. So we have a huge multi-billion-dollar trade deficit with China, according to the way records are kept. But the way records are kept are so 20th century, or actually early 20th century. It simply says that when an iPhone X crosses the border from its Foxconn factory in China to Cupertino or New York or wherever it's sold, Apple has to pay, I'm going to guess, roughly $400 out of $1,000 retail to China. That goes into China. So it goes on the books as a big trade deficit. But the problem with supply chains is that, well, first of all, that iPhone is made in a factory, Foxconn, Honhai, which is actually a Taiwanese company. It's not a Chinese company. That factory then has to source all of the components, and there are dozens that go into it, from other countries, from Japan, some cheap assembly from the Philippines, some from the U.S. And so by the time the dust settles, that money goes out of China. So one estimate I saw is that for a phone that retails for $1,000 in the U.S., an iPhone X, something like $9 stays in China. But it doesn't show up that way. So if you were to account for the way a supply chain operates, with components purchased from various places and then assembled and exported from the final destination, our trade deficit would go down by maybe 40% or more with China. So that's why I think that that whole accounting system is an illusion. But this is complicated to explain. So, you know, you can point to the number and say China has to import more for us. We have to import more from the U.S. We should stop getting all this stuff from China. But the stuff we're getting from China is our stuff. I mean, it's stuff that our firms like Apple design and make in China.
Do you think when the conversation takes place between our trade representative and the Chinese counterpart that they understand this, or are they just talking across purposes? Do you think in a private conversation they get it?
I wish I were there to answer that question. Any intelligent economist, any serious economist, understands how this works. The problem in the current environment is that Trump has staged his entire political career, his base, which famously continues to support him in, you know, large numbers, wants a wall, and they want the trade deficit with China ended. He campaigned on that. He talked on that long before he was running for president. This seems to be part of his limited understanding. You know, in his world, it's a zero-sum game, winners and losers. There's no win-win situation. And I think his representatives are trapped. What I would hope is happening when they meet with their Chinese counterparts, Chinese are very smart about these things, they're saying, okay, what I would hope is happening is they would say, okay, how can we both claim victory here? What is a win-win situation? Maybe China could give up on some things, U.S. could give up on a few other things. Both sides could claim victory.
Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, one of my many proposals, which I am making to you and the listeners of this program, is that there are some areas that where we could make some progress. Let me talk about a couple of things that are a challenge. I mentioned earlier that outright theft is a problem. So under the Obama administration, government theft, Chinese government hacking into U.S. businesses to get, you know, information, stuff like that. Under Obama, he met with Xi, and they actually created an agreement that would end Chinese government hacking of that sort. And by all accounts, and I've looked at the public records that are put out by the current government, that did definitely reduce the amount of hacking. That didn't stop the Trump administration from claiming that it had increased. And our former attorney general, may he be remembered, what's his name, right, from calling for, you know, a high-level group involving the FBI to pursue this doggedly. And there is some indication possibly that under Trump it has increased again because of this sort of open warfare. I think the Chinese could agree to stop doing that. I think they have moved high enough up in innovation that they no longer have to engage in or they no longer would see a benefit in terms of cost-benefit analysis in engaging in some of this. To take another example, forced technology transfer. So as I said earlier, when a U.S. business wants to do business in China, they sign an agreement with a Chinese company, could be a privately owned company or state-owned enterprise, and they basically share their technology. And then it remains, the patent remains with the original, say, U.S. firm. But if the Chinese innovate on the basis of it, then they get the patent to that innovation. So this we regard as technology theft. The Chinese government says this is voluntary. You know, this is a price the U.S. businesses are willing to pay to gain access to our huge market, to gain access to our own scientific talent, which is considerable. And no one is forcing them to do it. So I think there's a solution possibly there also. And that solution would be for China to make some concessions on that because, again, I think they are less needy of doing that. They could stake out some areas that are vital to their national security but, you know, maybe give up on some others. So that would be another thing. And finally, There are so many problems in the world today that need solutions, the environment being one of them, where the Chinese, as I said earlier, have made huge advances, where we could profitably partner with them if the Trump administration believed that there was an environmental problem, which is...
There was some irony there because some of, I've heard people complain that they've taken over the market in solar screens. Well, they realized that it was important to do that and had government help, and they took over the market, something we should be doing.
Right, so that brings me to my third pet peeve, which is China's industrial policy. The fact that China subsidized the solar industry, and we said, you're not playing fair. So that's another topic I think is worth talking about.
Yeah. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm here today with Dr. Richard Applebaum, Professor Emeritus at UCSB in the Departments of Global Studies and Sociology, and currently a professor at Fielding Graduate University. What are you teaching there?
At Fielding.
Yeah.
So Fielding Graduate University has been around now for 45 years. It is based in Santa Barbara. It's a fully accredited university that has a program both in clinical psychology and what we call leadership studies, human and organization development. And it is unusual in that it is aimed at mid-career, midlife adult professionals who want to go back to school but can't sit in a classroom forever because they have family commitments, job commitments, and so forth. And it is organized, its mission statement has to do with social justice, inclusiveness, and so forth. So we just had a national session at the former Fess Parker Hotel, I guess it's a Hilton now, down at Milpas and Cabrillo, where faculty came, so forth. My role there is I lead a doctoral concentration called Leadership in Social and Ecological Sustainability, which tries to bring together the environment but the social. Before I started focusing on China's high-tech turn, spent the first half of my career focusing on workers' rights, supply chains, sweatshops, things of that sort around the world. And so I try to bring together the social and environmental in this concentration. And we have students who have written dissertations on companies like Patagonia and so forth, looking at companies that are really trying to walk the talk.
So one of the real drivers for this current political split is the disparity in the economic situation of the population. We've never had such a, maybe we never had, never in the last 100 years, maybe we probably did back in the time of the robber barons, but today we have this disparity in wealth that's just incredible. How do you solve that problem, and do you have to solve that problem to reverse some of these negative trends in tribalization?
Yeah, so I have long thought, and nothing has changed my mind, that we now have the knowledge, the technological knowledge, to do this. Way back in the 70s, when I spent 2 years at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and one of my colleagues at the time, David Kershaw, ran a program, an income maintenance program, in New Jersey and the Pacific Northwest, where they experimented with a guaranteed annual income for poor people. And it was sort of a scientific study, a clinical study. They varied things like how much money people would get, how much they would be taxed on additional earnings, and so forth. And the results were overwhelmingly positive that such a thing would provide a safety net for people, better than welfare, would not discourage people from working. That was championed, by the way, as I recall, by Milton Friedman also. It didn't go anywhere politically. I think the problem, well, just to paraphrase Albert Einstein, since we haven't had any famous people to quote in the last couple segments, he said, the splitting of the atom has changed everything except the way people think. And I think the problem is the way people think. I think it's politics. If we faced a calamity that required the world to unite, a meteor coming, there was a great movie called The Day the Earth Stood Still, back in the 50s, which sort of played on that idea, we might come together and overcome our tribal differences. So the U.S. does have a huge amount of inequality as measured by the Gini index and various other indices.
I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation once. How much you have to raise taxes for everyone in order to have a really equal society? And it's not that big a deal. I mean, mm-hmm. It would be, in people like our class, maybe 3 percentage points you'd have to raise across the board. Why do you think really rich people would rather shoot themselves than do that? Is it are certain people just mean sociologically? I mean, they rather somebody go to work in a delicatessen or a fast food shop that they're going to eat in, sneezing into their food because they don't have time off for health, than to give that person the opportunity to stay home. It just, are they mean, crazy? What's the problem here?
Was it Anatole France who said the rich are different than you and I? They have more money. I can't answer that question. As a sociologist, sociologists tend to think of structures as shaping us in our education.
What about meanness? Can meanness be something you have to look at as a sociologist?
We tend not to. We don't like to blame the victim. We don't like to point the finger. We like to say, let's take Donald Trump. I'm going to do a little analysis of Donald Trump right now. So he grew up in a rich world. His father was not a nice guy. So I do think there's a psychological dimension to that. I think he probably grew up in a loveless environment. The man never laughs. I don't think he's ever been seen laughing. So there's that. And then, when you grow up with all sorts of riches around you, you take credit for it. The joke is he was born on third base and thinks he's hit a homer. So I think there's a social dimension. But here's the essence of sociology. Not that you asked, but I'll tell you. C. Wright Mill is one of the original leading lights of progressive sociology. Said, you have to understand the world in terms of the intersection of biography and history. History are all these external environments that help shape us, that provide the container, the constraints. Biography is who we are. Or to quote someone else who may have not yet been quoted on this program, Karl Marx, men make history, or I would say people make history, but not under circumstances of their own choosing. So I do think we are shaped by circumstances. And I think, you know, I think there are probably plenty of good Republican senators who feel boxed in now. They feel their careers might come to an end if they, because the Republican base remains pro-Trump, 80% of them or something, he still gets high approval ratings from the Republican base. I think they'd love to do something. I would bet there are enough Republicans in Congress who would like to change course but are afraid to do so for various reasons, including their own positions.
Yeah, well, you don't have to go back far in history to realize that, just look at Germany, that didn't end well, that kind of safety for myself and I'll, you know, worry about it tomorrow.
Right.
So I hope that's not the case. So at Fielding, is the level of students, and this is kind of an obvious answer I can see, but the level of students the same as UCSB? Are they, you know, they're older, it was probably easier to get into, I'm not sure, but is the level of students the same?
Well, first of all, it's very different because it's a PhD and some master's mm-hmm. programs, some certificate programs. The students who come to Fielding, for the most part, are successful mid-career professionals in businesses and nonprofits, sometimes in government, sometimes in education. So they bring a wealth of personal experience and knowledge. And Fielding was founded to try to valorize that experience to say all knowledge does not come out of a textbook. So we grapple with the issue of scholarship. And many students come to Fielding because they've been sort of doing stuff and they want to know what's the evidence basis for what they do. Yeah. So when they come, the best students would compare with the best students. That one of the first students I ever had at Fielding already had a master's degree from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Mm-hmm. He was a state senator from Alaska. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's hard to make generalizations.
Yeah, no, and in fact, the MBA programs, the really good ones across the country, value the students' experience because they really raise the whole classroom discussion. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and believe it or not, we'll be right back with our final segment.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a 4-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a 4-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm here today with Dr. Richard Applebaum, a professor who is solving all of the world's problems, and we're lucky to have him, and we only have four minutes left, but I think we can do it. You know, we talk about assets and we talk about technology, but one of the things that really drives an economy is smart people. Are we, when we close our borders, when we close trade, are we, and I see it in the statistics now, people don't want to come here. They'd rather go to Canada. Are we going to lose that lifeblood of innovation by not letting people in?
Absolutely. I mean, Silicon Valley, for example, is heavily dominated by people from India, China. Let's see, Robin Lee, WeChat, developed his ideas in the U.S. So I definitely think we will. China will lose out also. I mean, China was the largest sender of students to the U.S. and then has brought many of them back through what they call the 1,000 Talents Program. Mm-hmm. Those students come back with much better research habits. They're used to, in the U.S., working in laboratories where you can challenge the professor who runs it, where people get together and put their heads together to solve problems. Chinese labs tend to be much more authoritarian and much more difficult to be innovative that way. And I always saw this kind of exchange as having two major benefits. One, it will open up Chinese thinking and improve it. And the other is that there are brilliant Chinese scientists and brilliant, you know, China produces more PhDs now in science, technology, and mathematics than the U.S. does. So putting our heads together, I think, is crucial.
So what's your outlook? So in the final 2 minutes, what's your outlook for China?
So the big conflict I see right now is this. The U.S. came to its present position on the basis of free market economics. That was laid out after at the end of World War II in Bretton Woods in 1944, and it worked well because the U.S. was the only game in town, and then the rest of Europe and then Japan came along. But the U.S. got there not with free market economics. The Internet was a government defense program. One of the first nodes came through Santa Barbara. The highway system, the Manhattan Project, the space program, you could go on, the railroads, you could go on. All these were industrial policy, government policy. China's not doing the same thing, and we don't like it. We say they're not playing by the rules. They're not. China is changing the rules of the game, and they have, I think, the knowledge, the heft, and the central authority and the drive, as well as trillions of dollars in foreign exchange that we, in part, have given them to make it happen. I think we could learn from China. To answer your earlier question, what we should be doing about inequality is pouring money into artificial intelligence, automation, retraining people, school programs. We should act like a grown-up country and not a third-world country.
Yeah, and that's going to happen when?
Yes. Let's see. I've retired from. I've never been in politics. When is it going to happen? I don't know. Let's see. When Salud Carbajal makes it to the Senate, I have no idea when it's going to happen. It really will change. Require a sea change. I'll just say one final thing. Maybe once the environmental crisis, which is real, forces itself upon us, maybe that'll be the asteroid coming to hit the planet that'll compel people to see beyond their tribal differences.
Well, let's hope that's not too late. Richard Applebaum, it's really been great talking to you. It's really good to be able to talk to someone for an hour and feel that you have the answers to everything. We'll have to have you back and see how well we've done. Thank you for listening. You've been listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll see you next week.